listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
What binds us together in this hemisphere are shared democratic values.
That was U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson speaking at the University of Texas at Austin on February 1st, he was responding to this question from Professor Will Inboden, Executive Director of the Clements Center and a professor at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at UTA, about the Monroe Doctrine.
In a few years, we celebrate the 200th anniversary of the Monroe Doctrine, which for a very young United States was our assertion of our efforts to keep European colonial powers out of the Western Hemisphere, to protect our security, but also to promote the three pillars of the speech you talked about today, security, liberty, and prosperity. So you as Secretary, you kind of inherit that 200-year tradition. Looking back, how would you regard the Monroe Doctrine? Has it been more of a success or a failure, especially as you look at our challenges today?
Well, I think it clearly has been a success. I think it clearly was an important commitment at the time, and I think over the years that has all continued to frame the relationship. Having said that, it's easy for the United States as a country, because of our size and our engagements with so many countries and regions around the world, to, through nothing more than just perhaps a period of neglect, to let certain relationships atrophy a bit. And I think we've gone through those periods of time in our history as well. And if you look back, and whether you can go by individual country or regionally as well, due to other events, sometimes I think we have forgotten about the importance of the Monroe Doctrine and what it meant to this hemisphere and maintaining those shared values. So I think it's as relevant today as it was the day it was written.
The Monroe Doctrine was the term coined for U.S. policy in the Americas beginning in 1823 under U.S. President James Monroe. Its stated objective was to free the newly independent states of Latin America and the Caribbean from European intervention. The Monroe Doctrine, under its terms, stated that it was opposed to colonialism in the Western Hemisphere. Washington has referred to the Monroe Doctrine with respect to efforts by China and, to a lesser extent, Russia to reach agreements with various countries in Latin America and the Caribbean. Tillerson himself has characterized China's involvement in the Western Hemisphere as neocolonialism. For more on that, we spoke with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, from Managua, Nicaragua, via Skype Thursday.
Let's look at that those remarks by Rex Tillerson and follow where the ramifications lead us.
Okay.
Because from my point of view, looking at the broader panorama of Latin America and the Caribbean, Rex Tillerson's remarks confirm that what we're dealing with in terms of the resurgence of right-wing governments using any subterfuge or any dirty trick possible to get into power, you know, soft coups or abusing institutional rules, abusing the judiciary. None of that has anything to do with democratic process. It's got nothing to do with the people of Latin America and the Caribbean saying, oh, the left wing and progressive policies were wrong after all. We're going to support right wing policies because we think that that's the best alternative to improve our lives.
Right.
It's got nothing to do with that.
Right.
What it's got to do with is, and Rex Tillerson has explicitly confirmed this now, it's got to do with a deliberate drive by the United States, given its foreign policy failures everywhere else in the world, to try and shore up its prestige, power, influence, control, status in Latin America and the Caribbean, which it's always regarded as its backyard. And when recently Donald Trump made those infamous remarks about, what was it, and can I use this word, whole countries, that caused such consternation among people, and all he was saying, he was just saying out loud what most of the United States and European elite think about impoverished countries in Latin America and elsewhere. So they have the United States and Europe are faced with this rapidly closing window of opportunity, where they have to try and do something to protect their power and influence in the world against the increasingly assertive multipolar world, led mainly by China and Russia principally, but with Venezuela and Iran not far behind in terms of resisting doing what the United States wants. And that is the fundamental criteria of foreign policy for the United States. If a country does what they want, it's sheer gangster diplomacy. Do what we want or else.
Right. Do what I'm telling you. But, you know, it's interesting, too, let me interrupt for a moment, but to go to what Tillerson said in Austin, I'm looking at Foreign Policy Magazine, the link that you sent to me. It's Tillerson took particular aim at China's economic approach to Latin America, which focused on gaining access to commodities from countries such as Brazil, Venezuela, Argentina, and Peru, but which has left little lasting benefit for those countries. This is foreign policy speaking now. And so here goes Tillerson. Latin America does not need new imperial powers that seek only to benefit their own people. I guess that's in contrast to the former and, you know, 200-year imperial power that sought only to benefit a few of our own people. But okay. Mm-hmm. And he says, this is the nested truth here. China's state-led model of development is reminiscent of the past. It doesn't have to be this hemisphere's future. In other words, the real problem is the fact that you have such a large public sector in the economy, or the real problem is they're sharing the money with the people instead of sending it to us.
Yeah, and it's such a disingenuous travesty of what in fact is happening, because everybody knows that China's trade and commercial and technical development cooperation policies are based on win-win, and so that everybody benefits from that relationship.
Right.
And you can see that. And one of the countries that's been most successful at that in building its relationship with China has been Venezuela. And of course, that's one of the reasons, among many, why Venezuela is the target of an absolutely ruthless attack by the United States, its European allies, and local regional elites.
Right.
So we've talked about this so many times. And look at who is Rex Tillerson. And he's the ex chief executive, isn't he?
ExxonMobil, right. Yeah, right.
So now, and what is Exxon doing right at this minute? Exxon has entered into an illegal oil exploration and exploitation deal off the coast of Guyana in maritime territory that's been disputed by Venezuela with Guyana for well over a century.
I mean, you can flesh that out even more. One, they're clearly stealing Venezuela's oil through this bogus claim by Guyana. In addition to that, they're competing with Venezuela's oil in the marketplace. And in addition to that, what they're doing is looking to set policy generally for how corporations like ExxonMobil deal with the places that have the commodities that they trade in.
Right. So, and in political terms, and the results of Tillerson's trip through Latin America, I think he visited Colombia and Argentina, among other places. Now, Colombia is a completely failed state. It's got more displaced people as a result of armed conflict than any country in the world, even more than Syria.
Yep.
I might be wrong about that, but
it's been going on 60 years instead of since 2011. Yeah. So it's clearly it's a mess.
Right, and so in January, almost 30 community leaders were murdered by paramilitaries, and in one case, a young girl died in a bombardment, an indigenous girl in what was supposed to be a protected indigenous territory, died in a bombardment by the Colombian Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
Now, somehow, the mainstream media might try to spin Colombia's reality in such a way as to make Venezuela appear the basket case country, when in fact Colombia is the basket case country.
Right. Yep.
No? And so, and if in a single month in Venezuela, 27 community leaders had been murdered and a young girl blown up by the Venezuelan Air Force, can you imagine what the headlines would be like?
Yeah.
But for Colombia, there's nothing. It barely even registers as a footnote in the inner pages of the main mainstream corporate media.
Mm.
So there's this deep underlying hypocrisy at almost every level, in the political level, in the Western media, on an economic level. The economic arguments around Latin America are almost always grossly dishonest and lacking in a focus on realities. But going back to what Tillerson said about China, and what he's doing there is confirming what we've been saying in almost every conversation we ever have about the general development of Latin America's foreign relations with the rest of the world. Even the right-wing elites in Latin America and the Caribbean recognize that they get a better deal with China than they do with the United States.
Right.
Now, what Rex Tillerson has done is going back to the political ramifications, the Venezuelan opposition and the Venezuelan government about 10 days ago were on the verge. They negotiated right down to the fine print, an agreement for coexistence, a political and agreement about coexistence in Venezuela. At the very last minute, on the day that the Venezuelan opposition negotiators were due to sign the agreement, the lead negotiator got a call from Colombia, where Rex Tillerson just happened to be at the time, and turned around and said that there would be no deal.
Mm.
So that is an absolutely clear indication that the United States is directly intervening in a way like the puppet masters of the Venezuelan opposition. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to contradict that reading of that episode. So, and in the same way, In Colombia, within Colombia itself, the ELN guerrilla group had been in peace negotiations with the administration of President Juan Manuel Santos. There was some incident, a relatively minor incident, and on that pretext, that around the same time that, of Tillerson's visit, Juan Manuel Santos pulled out of the peace talks, and now he's issued arrest warrants for the ELN leadership that were participating in that peace process.
Right.
So there again, you have another direct political ramification of this latest swerve, if you like, in U.S. policy, whereby they've explicitly reinstated the Monroe Doctrine. But what they're essentially saying is, obviously, we don't want China, we don't want our Latin American backyard to be having to have anything to do with China, or as little to do as possible.
Right.
Now, that's very difficult at this point, and I think that the once again, just as they failed elsewhere in the Middle East, in Southeast Asia, in the Korean Peninsula crisis, U.S. foreign policy is failing across the board,
yep.
And they're going to fail here in Latin America too. Although there may be apparent positive results from their point of view, but in the short term, but over the medium and long term, that policy is going to fail, because what they're doing is, if you look at the way they're increasing their military presence, what they're doing is they're taking advantage of essentially illegitimate right-wing governments in Brazil, in Argentina. And when I say illegitimate, I don't mean that they didn't get elected, but what those governments are doing is completely the contrary to what the platform on which they were elected.
Well, actually, in Brazil, they didn't get elected. They removed the elected president.
Or in Ecuador. And let's look at Ecuador in a minute. But going back to this issue of how the United States is exploiting its relationships with right-wing usurper governments to increase its military presence, they've now agreed to establish a military stroke security base in northern Argentina that on the pretext of their drug war. The drug war is the pretext that they always use, even that we know very well that the United States authorities themselves are up to their eyes in involvement in trafficking drugs.
Absolutely.
And laundering money.
Right.
That's an open secret. But they continue to use the drug war as a pretext to militarize their relations in Latin America. Now, why do they want a base in northern Argentina? Because, in my opinion, China has agreed with Bolivia, Peru, and Brazil a transcontinental railway that will run from southern Peru across the Andes, across southern Brazil, just north of where that new military base is going to be based.
That's right.
And at the same time, the United States is increasing its military cooperation with the Brazilian armed forces, which is unprecedented in recent decades. And it's also increasing the level of its military exercises with other countries, like, for example, Peru and Colombia. And remember that in Colombia, they've already got 6 or 7 bases, which they're using to monitor all kinds of aspects of the local regional situation, but in particular, to monitor what's going on in Venezuela. Now, Juan Manuel Santos and the Venezuela has been very, very critical of the Venezuelan authorities ever since that visit by Tillerson. Is noticeably ramping up his rhetoric against Venezuela. He went so far as to call Venezuela a pathetic country, which, from coming from him.
Right.
And coming from the government of Colombia, where they blow 13-year-old indigenous girls to smithereens,
right,
and is beyond pathetic itself. So that it was very interesting to see over the last couple of days that a news item whereby Juan Manuel Santos and the government of President Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela have agreed to hold talks about frontier security. Now, that should be seen in the context whereby something over a year ago, maybe a little more, Venezuela completely sealed and shut off all cross-border activity at the border points between Colombia and Venezuela.
Right.
And I wouldn't be surprised if behind the scenes, and Nicolas Maduro was saying to Santos, look, either you bring the illicit activities and the hostile activities that you have been promoting against Venezuela, in particular as regards to the economic war, because what the Colombian authority, among many things that the Colombian authorities have done, is the Colombian authorities have allowed local casas de cambio, that's some offices that are allowed to change money changes, to set the rate of exchange between Colombia's currency and Venezuelan's currency locally. So it's not set from a central authority. And that's one of the things that's contributed to the very, very disruptive wave of speculation, currency speculation,
right,
that has contributed to the economic crisis in Venezuela.
I mean, what you're talking about basically is the fact that they have lost control of the money supply to that extent.
So these talks that have been set up between Santos and Maduro, and who knows what's being said behind the scenes, but as an educated guess, I'd suspect that Maduro has again said to Santos, look, either you stop your hostile activities towards Venezuela, among which, for example, are executive orders from the Colombian government making it impossible for Venezuela to buy medicines in Colombia. Kind of thing.
Right.
And so Maduro will be saying to Santos, look, shape up or we're going to close the border. And that will have a devastating effect on the local communities all along the border, economic effect on the Colombian side, at a time when the Colombian politicians are going into elections. And so.
Good. Yeah, right.
Maduro is almost certainly saying that to Santos. Shape up, or I'm going to make your life electorally very, very difficult.
Good.
for the electoral participants that Juan Manuel Santos favors because he can't take part in the election.
Right.
So that's what's happening in Colombia. And then let's shift a little to Ecuador. If you look at what's happening in Ecuador, Rex Tillerson's remarks about reinstating the Monroe Doctrine and very, very apt in the sense that they fit in with what the President Lenin Moreno has decided to do in Ecuador, which is to apply a right-wing agenda. And he's been in office almost a year now, but he still hasn't implemented the policies that he says he's going to implement to make Ecuador a paradise for everybody. Why not? Because he was waiting to hold a referendum that he could pass off as a popular vote on his policies. And that referendum was held, I think we discussed it briefly in a very hurried way in our last conversation. That referendum was a vote of seven questions covering a huge range of diverse areas in Ecuador's national life. But the fundamental point about that referendum is that it was unconstitutional. In a very fundamental sense, and I don't just mean in terms of breaking the rules. Lenin Moreno exploited a loophole in Ecuador's constitution that only an extremely unscrupulous person would do. But beyond that, there was no real discussion about when Ecuador back in 2006, when Rafael Correa took power. Was elected to the presidency. He spent 2 years trying to work with all sectors in the Ecuadorian in Ecuador to devise a new constitution, which was eventually passed in 2008, the Monte Cristi Constitution. He took 2 years to work that out based on genuine popular consultation. Okay. Now, what Lenin Moreno did is a classic right-wing ploy of railroading through legislation in a very short time period, saying, people, we don't have time, we have to discuss this very important issue and get that decided, and then we can make the country better. And he, and that all happened within a space of about 2 months,
right.
Never mind 2 years. So in that fundamental sense, what Lenin Moreno and his team did with that referendum was grossly abuse Ecuador's institutions in order to force through what is essentially a right-wing agenda, because that is what Lenin Moreno and Lenin Moreno's electoral opposition during the presidential elections, the right-wing opposition was saying, we have to have this referendum. Now, Lenin Moreno won that election on a radical platform that was somewhat watered down through between the first and second rounds of that presidential vote. But he still was elected on a radical platform that he's completely betrayed. And he's now implementing very, very clearly, essentially, the agenda of the right wing who lost the election, which is totally bizarre. But at the same time, it's very much in tune with Rex Tillerson's remarks about reinstating U.S. interest in the region and ensuring that their brand, that the U.S. style of kind of what he called democracy, but in what is in fact the very opposite of democracy,
right.
should prevail in Latin America. And Lenin Moreno is very much in tune with that. Now, he too now is going to have talks with his Colombian counterpart, Juan Manuel Santos, about border security, but that is targeted at trying to reinforce the Colombian government's efforts to eradicate, if possible, the ELN guerrilla activities. And also, almost certainly, they'll be talking about Juan Manuel Santos will be trying to persuade Lenin Moreno to take a much harder line against Venezuela.
Right.
Now, we've spoken in the past about Lenin Moreno's likely moves over the next year or so, and I've suggested that one of the things that he's likely to do is to either outright withdraw from the ALBA progressive bloc of countries, that framework, or to drag his feet and be a negative influence inside ALBA and go for full membership for Ecuador of the Pacific Alliance group of countries that are trying to work on a free market, neoliberal style model of economic development. But from Tillerson's point of view, that itself, that too is problematic, because the Pacific Alliance countries, that's Chile, Mexico, Colombia, and Peru, they are developing their relationship with China, because the United States pulled out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, China stepped into the breach and is trying to encourage the countries that were ready to sign the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement to work in an economic and commercial and technical cooperation framework designed by China, working with them. And now what's happened is that the countries that were going to join the TPP until the US withdrew have managed to reconstitute it, a bit like Frankenstein, and put something back together without the United States.
Right.
But that is absolutely insane. And they, because they, if they set that up without China, and the Pacific Alliance countries are going to find themselves kind of dealing with two separate frameworks. And it really, I looked at from an overall commercial and trade and technical cooperation perspective, it really doesn't make sense for the TPP countries to set up on their own and ignoring China, which was the original point of the TPP, as you yourself have pointed out,
right.
Don.
That's right.
So those kinds of contradictions between the outright right-wing governments like Mexico and Colombia and Argentina, governments like that of Chile and Lenin Moreno, and to some extent Peru, that are kind of not entirely in the right-wing camp because of their own contradictions. And Peru is trying to work with Bolivia, for example. Okay, so you have the extreme right-wing countries that are fully on board with the United States agenda. You have these countries that are kind of on board with it, like Chile, Peru, now that there's a right-wing president in Chile, Chile will probably align much more closely with Argentina and Colombia and Mexico. But, for example, Peru and Ecuador are kind of they're in two minds because of their relationship with China. Ecuador also has strong relations with China. So, and then you have the countries that are opposed to all that, Cuba, Venezuela, Bolivia, Nicaragua. And then you have this kind of extraordinary situation in Brazil whereby Brazil, the Brazilian elites, they are at the cusp of this need to decide or need to negotiate this difficult relationship between do we go with China, do we go with the United States, what are the advantages for us as an elite, what are the advantages that we may consider having to think about for the Brazilian population in terms of us maintaining some level of domestic political support. What I'm trying to say in brief is I don't think Tillerson's explicit resuscitation of the Monroe Doctrine is going to be successful. That essentially is my take on Tillerson's remarks.
Yeah, and it's certainly much more complex than just saying, okay, fine, we're turning the Monroe Doctrine back on now. And we'll pick that up next week when we speak again. Tony, thank you very much.
Okay, you're very welcome, Don. Thanks for talking to me.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The stakes couldn't be higher, and it's happening in Syria. The goal of destroying the Islamic State is largely complete. Now, the Syrian proxy war is entering a new stage. Who are the players, and what are their aims? And what does winning mean? Crosstalking what's next for Syria, I'm joined by my guest, Abdel Bari Atwan in London. He's an expert on political Islam and author of Islamic State, the Digital Caliphate. In Beirut, we have Marwa Osman. She is a journalist and university lecturer. And in Tehran, we cross to Mohammed Mirandi. He's an associate professor at the University of Tehran. Okay, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Marwa, let me go to you, because you're the closest to what we're talking about here. There's so many different things going on, contradictory trends going on in Syria right now. I think we're all very familiar what has happened in the last 6-7 years. Would you say that this conflict is taking on a new form? Is it morphed into something? And is it more dangerous than what we've seen before? Go ahead in Beirut.
Yes, definitely, especially after the talks in Sochi. We saw last week was a hectic week inside of Syria, beginning in February 4, when we had the first launching of Israeli, the first in this month of launching of Israeli attacks on the outskirts of Damascus countryside, killing SAA and allies and certain military posts for the allies of the Syrian Arab Army. And then again on Tuesday, 2 days later, they did the same. And then the big happening that also happened delayed between Thursday and Friday when the U.S. bombed SAA positions in Deir ez-Zor, killing more than 100 members of the army, alongside with reports saying that there were also Russians on board. We still don't have a confirmation from the Kremlin on that. And then what happened late on Saturday, or dawn of Saturday, with the downing of the Israeli jet over occupied territories in Syria, which was a very dramatic development, if I may, for the war inside of Syria, for all the happenings that were going on, especially, again, I would like to reiterate, after the Sochi talks, which brought about several very important points for the upcoming solutions inside of the Syrian conflict, for possible dialogues to be conducted between the warring parties. What is happening is a very big indication that the U.S. is very much paranoid of what will happen next in Syria.
That's a very good point. Abdel, let me go to you in London, because we have the three players, Turkey, Russia, and Iran. They don't all see eye to eye on all of the issues. However, American behavior in Syria is bringing those three countries together. We have word that there's going to be a conference in Istanbul. The date hasn't been set yet. But the U.S. is a galvanizing point for these regional players now. And the U.S. has made it very clear it isn't going anywhere. This is one of the reasons why I'm doing this program here, because they say they're not leaving. They don't really justify their illegal existence in a sovereign country where they were never invited in the first place. And we have the Israelis on the move. Go ahead, in London.
Peter, it is very critical time for the whole players in the region. I believe United States said clearly that they are there to stay. This irritates many people in the region. Why they want to stay? They are there simply because of the Islamic State, because of the danger of the terrorist organization. Islamic State collapsed completely. It has no capital. It has no territories, some pockets here or there. So why the American has 2,000 troops in Syria and about 6,000 troops in Iraq? This is the biggest question now. I believe the major challenge for United States is what they are going to do in north of Syria. Are they going to establish a Kurdish state there? Yeah. Are they going to lose, you know, their Turkish ally? Are they going to enter confrontation with Syria, with Turkey, even with Russia in that part of the world? Why they are supplying the Kurds with very sophisticated weapons? And also, there are some terrorist organization of iPad missiles where they managed to use it to down a Russian Sukhoi jet. So this is the biggest question. I believe you talked about, Peter, Istanbul conference. This is very important.
Yep.
Three major countries, major power, are going to meet there. And I believe this kind of meeting, I mean, Turkey, Russia, Iran, this is the major player in the region. If they decided actually to meet, and they will meet, I think the top of the agenda will be how to confront United States influence, how to confront their troops in Syria. This is the biggest challenge, I believe, for the American.
Mohammed, in Tehran, the interesting thing is, when you look at all of the players involved, and we've only named a few of them here, there are many more, not one of them wants to see the United States in northern Syria, except for some misguided Kurds, okay? And I would point out to the Kurds is that the U.S. usually turns away from its, you know, temporary allies and leaves or turns against them. Okay, so the Kurds historically choose the wrong side. I think they're doing it again here. What is the U.S. doing? Does it just want to be a spoiler? Or does it want to partition? Does it want to keep the region unstable? Of course, everything I just said would benefit Israel. Go ahead, Mohammed.
I think that's the point. Everything that the United States does in this region is about Israel. The only real ally of the United States is Israel. And even Saudi Arabia, the only reason why it's considered to be a U.S. ally is because it moves in a way in which it is within the framework of the interests of the Israeli regime. If we go back to the beginning of of the crisis in Syria and the famous 2012 Defense Intelligence Agency document, there was an attempt to establish a Salafist and extremist regime between Syria and Iraq in order to isolate Syria. And those extremists, they were being supported by U.S. allies in the region. And as General Michael Flynn, who was the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency at that time, admitted on Al Jazeera, the United States took a willful decision to support those extremists. So the United States back then was supporting an attempt to take over the east of Syria. Later on, when the tide turned with the help of Russia, Iran, Hezbollah, the Iraqis, Afghani volunteers, and ISIS began to lose ground and territory, it was only then that the United States changed its policy. Before that, the United States was allowing ISIS to thrive. It allowed trade to go on between Turkey and ISIS. We know from Kerry, the Secretary of State of the United States, in a leaked audio file that he told the Syrian opposition people that the United States allowed ISIS to advance on Damascus to put pressure on President Assad. So only when the tide turned did the United States decide to start fighting ISIS. And that was because they wanted a piece of Syria so that they could basically pursue the same policy
which
that they
Mohammed, let me point out the rise
of the extremists.
Let me point out to our viewers, of course, Donald Trump is taking complete credit for the diminished state of ISIS. That's what you'll learn in Western media. It is really, really remarkable. Marwa, I can say, yeah, I agree with you, Marwa, in Beirut here. I mean, also what's really at stake here is there looks like there is a game of chicken being played. The United States and Israel getting very aggressive, and there are Russian troops there. They are legally, they were invited there by the legal government in Damascus, and it looks like the Pentagon is itching for some kind of conflict. And I would be I would tell the Pentagon to be very careful because the Russians don't bluff. Go ahead in Beirut.
Exactly. And if you read the mainstream media that was out on Wednesday and Thursday of this week in the U.S., you could see how they were gloating about the fact that they were bombing the posts of the SAA and where they most probably have directly hit the Russian servicemen. We don't know if they are part of the army or not. So we're gloating, and they were saying, we are at war with Russia inside of Syria. This is no longer a secret. So not only that they are pushing for some sort of a confrontation with Russia, but they are also under the ground working for this confrontation. I mean, could you tell me when has the U.S. ever bombed the ISIS-controlled areas of Deir ez-Zor before it was liberated?
Nope.
Never. Why are they now bombing the areas that have been liberated by the Syrian Arab Army and its allies? Why? Because they don't want them to advance furthermore to the areas where they occupy, which are the oil-rich, obviously oil-rich areas in Deir ez-Zor. And as well, they want to keep away from the SDF, the so-called SDF, which we don't have real information about, except the fact that there were ISIS members that evaporated. And then there was something called the Syrian Defense Forces.
Oh, yeah.
So it's not only Kurds that we are talking about here. So
it's really amazing how they suddenly evaporate. You know, they're just airlifted out. That's what happens here. Okay, Abdel, let me go to you here.
Exactly.
I mean, this is the United States. I mean, it's interesting the area of northern Syria they're controlling. That's really where the Syria's oil is. Okay, and denying Syria the ability to rebuild. As a matter of fact, you know, telling the entire world that they will be sanctioned if you give money to the government in Damascus to rebuild. Another round of sanctions against rebuilding a country that the United States has a great deal of responsibility for destroying in the first place. Go ahead in London.
Well, I believe the United States realized that they were defeated in Syria. Their project in Syria was completely defeated. And Russia got the upper hands. And the next stage, I mean, it could be the rebuilding of Syria again. So rebuilding needs money. And Syria needs the oil and the gas, which is in eastern of Deir ez-Zor, where the oil fields are situated. So it seems that the American would like to prevent Syria, prevent Russia from actually putting their hands on the oil reserves, on the gas reserves. So I don't think they will succeed here. I have a lot of information saying that the next stage could be actually a guerrilla war against the American forces in Syria and also in Iraq. So if this happened, like what happened after the American occupation of Iraq in 2003, I think this will be devastating to the United States. I believe Russia wouldn't sacrifice its sacrifices and the heavy price which they paid in Syria since 2015. They paid blood, they paid money.
Let me jump in here.
They wouldn't let the American win here.
Let me jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and I'd like to point out to everyone, since the Pentagon can do anything it wants because it has more money than God right now, it is no longer a political issue in the United States. That's a tragedy. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on what's next for Syria. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Okay, let me go back to Mohammed and Tehran. I mean, I started out by talking about this conference that's scheduled for Istanbul that will have Turkey, Russia, and Iran. Mohammed, it's really interesting what's going on with Turkey here because, again, they're butting heads with the U.S. in northern Syria. And I'm not giving any justification for the illegal invasion of Syria by Turkey. But the interesting gambit that is being played out here is the two most important countries in NATO are at odds with each other in a third country that has nothing to do with NATO, NATO's sphere of influence, let's put it that way. The interesting thing is that you see the Turks are really looking at different options right now, okay? I'm not convinced they're the most reliable partner, but a lot of people feel that way, including NATO. I think we're seeing a real drift here. I don't think Turkey would give up NATO. They would want something for it, okay? A lot of people are saying they're going to walk away. No. They'll leverage their way one way or another here. But that's really the changing, shifting sands of what's going on because of this proxy war in Syria. Go ahead, Tehran.
Well, Trump actually promised the Turkish president that the U.S. will stop funding the YPG, which is a PKK affiliate, a terrorist organization that's killed many Turks. And then almost immediately afterwards, the military in the United States started to make noise that we will continue to support the Syrian Democratic Forces, which basically is a front for the YPG and the PKK. One wonders who's in charge
exactly.
In the United States. And it sort of reminds one of what happened in 2016 when the U.S. administration and the U.S. Secretary of State at that time, he made an agreement with the Russians. And then almost immediately afterwards,
the U.S. military bombed
Syrian government positions in Deir ez-Zor, killing almost 100 Syrian soldiers. And immediately afterwards, the ISIS attacked their positions and took those positions as if they were as if they knew what was about to happen. So the United States is unclear who's in charge, but we do know that Trump has given a huge amount of authority to the military.
Yep.
And the people in charge right now in the United States, the sort of junta, McMaster, Kelly, and their close friend Petraeus, these people... They are revisionists. Alistair Crook of Conflicts Forum, the head of Conflicts Forum, wrote a very interesting article recently showing how these people, Mattis as well, that these people are revisionists, Vietnam revisionists. And they believe that if the United States Army had been, the armed forces had been given the authority to, you know, destroy North Vietnam, that they would have won the war. And if it wasn't for the politicians and the military command, the United States could have won. So these are the sort of people with that sort of mentality. And I think that that may partially be part of the reason why they're taking such a hard stand in northern Syria.
It's very It's very interesting, though, that if Harry Truman would have given MacArthur that kind of authority, we would have had the Third World War. The generals report
Absolutely.
To the politician, but if the politician is AWOL, and I think that's the case right now, this is what we get. Let me go to Marwa in Beirut. Let's go a little bit closer home to you. There's a lot of open chatter right now with the Israel's height and involvement. I mean, it's, you know, what is it over the, even the last year? It was illegally violated Syria's airspace, and it looks like now the Syrians are not accepting that, and they're making it very clear. But there's a lot of talk, chatter, that Israel is eyeing another war against Hezbollah, again, fighting a war against Lebanon. And it seems this all kind of goes into it because that is the paradigm of Hezbollah and Iran. That's their narrative right here. Interestingly enough, you have the United States based in Syria as well. Well, I mean, the puzzle pieces seem to be coming together. Go ahead in Beirut.
Yes, I definitely agree with that, especially after the blow that was taken by the Israeli occupation air force on Saturday when the jet, when the F-16 jet was downed by the Syrian Arab army over occupied Syrian land. I mean, they were hoping for some kind of a war to start, whether in the southern part of Syria or with Lebanon for that matter. But after that hit, they are now thinking 1,000 times before they do so. Even at dawn on Thursday this week, a surveillance drone was sent from Israel into Syrian territory, and it was also attacked by the Syrian anti-missile system. The anti-aircraft system, and they fled. They went back into Palestinian occupied territories. So now even a drone, a surveillance drone, is not being able to go and attack the sovereignty of Syria for that matter. Now, when we talk about a possible war between Hezbollah and the Israeli entity, I don't think that the front would be this time the southern part of Lebanon, the southern border with occupied Palestine. I think that the Syrian Golan Heights would be the great place that we should all put our eyes into, because first of all, that's an occupied territory. Second of all, it has been for the past 6 years at least where the resistance, the armed forces of the resistance, whether Hezbollah or other allies, have been putting their efforts in there to try and start some sort of a new front with the Israeli entity, because that's the front that Israel is most afraid of.
Let's continue with Syria here. I mean, when we hear again from the Trump administration, you know, Assad must go here. I mean, what does that mean? Is that the justification for the United States to stay in Syria? Because this is how we started out the program. I mean, why does the United States want to stay in Syria and not make peace and leave like everybody wants them to leave? Everyone does, including their sometimes on and off friends in Iraq. Go ahead, in London.
Peter, I agree with you. Definitely, the American military presence in Syria and Iraq actually is not legitimate one. Now, the Syrian and the Iraqi are calling for the American to pull out their troops because they don't want them anymore, simply because they were there to fight the Islamic State. There is no more Islamic State as they pretended or as they were talking about. Now the situation is completely different. About 2 weeks ago, the Israeli media were talking about some sort of agreement between the United States and Israel to destabilize Iran and Syria. And it seems that the downing of the Israeli F-16 on the Syrian, after the Syrian attack, actually, it means that it is a clear message from Russia to United States, to Israel, that we are not going to let you go ahead with this plans to destabilize Iran and Syria. So I think the American will face a huge trouble. Russia now is strong. Russia has the upper hand in Syria. Turkey is turning against America, saying that you stabbed us in the back. You will see, you know, five times more Vietnam experience in Syria and in the region. So the Syrian now actually threatening that any Israeli warplane violate the airspace will be shot down. So I believe it is a tension, but that three major power, superpower in the region, Iran, Turkey, and Russia, they are actually waiting for the American to do something stupid. And I believe when Hezbollah got about 150,000 missiles, and we don't know how many thousands or 100,000 of missiles in the Iran arsenal or in Syrian arsenal, I believe the tension is huge now. We have to wait for the Istanbul conference. And it will be determined in this field.
But what I think also, the two tipping points that I'm worried about is Israel attacking Lebanon again. I mean, if you listen to Israeli military officials, active duty and retired, I mean, it's full on the airwaves. Of course, it's never reported in Western media, never reporting, never hear about that. Mohammed, let me go to you. I mean, if you look at the Israeli criticism and justification for its violation of Syrian airspace, the most recent spat, it's all because Iran has bases, supplies. It was if Syria doesn't even exist, okay? But of course, it doesn't exist in the minds of Israeli foreign policymakers. It doesn't at all. There are no sovereign countries around Israel. There are just places where you can go meddle. But that's what, when I looked at the response, and of course, it was echoed like a stenographer in Washington Washington, D.C. They said exactly the same thing as the Israelis. But it's really directed against Iran. And Abdel said something a few minutes ago, waiting for the Americans to do something stupid. Well, the stupid thing would be in conjunction with Israel attacking Iran. Go ahead, Mohammed.
Well, the Israelis like to use Iran as a scapegoat to justify their aggression on neighboring countries and also to subjugate the Palestinian people. It's very similar to what its sister apartheid regime in South Africa used to do when they would demonize the ANC. Nelson Mandela and the ANC were communists. And in the West, they'd pass laws against them too. In the United States, the ANC was a terrorist organization, and so was President Mandela when he was president. The law wasn't changed. So when he would go to the United Nations General Assembly, he'd have to get special permission, the president of South Africa, to enter the country because he was the head of a terrorist organization. So that's so by using communism, apartheid South Africa pursued those policies against neighboring countries and against the African majority, the black majority, and the Israeli regime, apartheid regime, does the same. But I think there's a big difference now today than before. First of all, Israel does not have the naval superiority that it had before. Its trade is vulnerable to missiles from in the Mediterranean. Its air superiority is questionable. And I personally think that there are more advanced surface-to-air missiles out there that are being kept under lock and key. And on the ground, the Israelis have lost the war to Hezbollah before. And this time round, you have Syria too, you have Gaza, and you have many people, the people from the Popular Mobilization Force in Iraq, who would come to the aid of Syria and Hezbollah if there is a war. And the government in Lebanon, unlike before, supports the resistance in southern Lebanon. So I don't think it is at all a winnable war for Israel.
Well,
I think it would be much more devastating than before. We've run out of time,
but what we've discussed in this program is certainly the shifting sands in the region. Many thanks to my guests in London, Beirut, and in Tehran. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk Rules.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.